Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
So the Canadian media, for example, fundamentally supported the U.S. and Canadian-backed coup in Honduras 10 years ago. The Canadian media, while addressing the plight of some of the migrants being forced to flee and try and get into the U.S., is religiously not asking the questions as to what Canadian and U.S. policy has to do with creating those conditions.
That's the voice of Graham Russell from Rights Action. On this week's show, we speak to Graham on the 10th anniversary of the Honduran coup. We also speak about the migrant crisis and how the U.S. and Canadian foreign policies have created this crisis and how our mainstream media is absolutely complicit in all this.
You are listening to Latin Waves. I'm your host, Sylvia Richardson, and I'm delighted to be joined by Graham Russell. He is an amazing author. He's also the founder of Rights Action. Welcome to our program, Graham.
Hi, Sylvia. Glad to be speaking with you again.
Thank you so much for being with us. Can you briefly give us an introduction of what Rights Action mandate is, and how did you get started?
Well, very briefly, I mean, I've been with Rights Action for about 25 years, and we do two main things. We directly fund community defense struggles in Guatemala and Honduras. And by community defense struggles, I mean sort of indigenous rights defense struggles, environmental defense struggles, human rights defense struggles throughout Guatemala and Honduras. The second main thing we do is we focus a lot of critical attention on how the policies of the Canadian U.S. governments and the policies and operations of many global corporations and investors are very much part of the problem in Guatemala and Honduras. So many of these community defense struggles that we fund are people, indigenous and non-indigenous people, who are trying desperately to stay on their lands and not have their rights violated by mining companies, hydroelectric dam projects, the production of African palm, sugarcane, bananas, and pineapples for export, tourism projects, etc. The point of all of this is that the work that we're involved with in Guatemala and Honduras, we're working on sort of Canadian and U.S. problems down there. We're not simply helping Guatemalans and Hondurans with their problems. Many of their problems come from the global economy, from Canadian and U.S. government policies and our economic interests. And so we directly support them in these struggles, and then we partner with them in trying to draw critical attention on back in Canada and the U.S. on how we're part of the problem.
I love that you point out that we're not there to help out, you know, sort of like the white knight saving people, but rather to partner and to recognize that the land defines us all, right? It is part of who we are. So let's talk a little bit about that struggle, because in the news we see a lot of images of caravans fleeing towards the United States. So can we talk a little bit about who are these people in these caravans? Where are they coming from?
That's as useful a starting point to understand this stuff as any, because over the last year and a half, even in the Canadian media, let alone the U.S. media, there's been a fair bit of attention paid to the fact that hundreds of thousands of people are trying to cross the U.S. border and apply for asylum. And in recent years, a majority of those people are coming from Guatemala and Honduras. They're coming from other countries as well, but a majority are coming from two countries in particular, Honduras and Guatemala. And what the media, I'm pretty sure, never addresses, certainly the mainstream media, they simply will not address the fact that the corrupt repressive regimes in power in Guatemala and Honduras are fully backed. They're politically, economically, and militarily backed by the U.S. government, by the Canadian government. They happily do business with a whole host of international companies and investors, including the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, and then companies and investors in the sectors of the economy that I mentioned. And so without overly simplifying things, it is the Canadian government and U.S. government and these international companies and investors are directly contributing to and helping create the conditions of violence, corruption, exploitation, and destitution that are forcing tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, to flee their home countries. So that is the story about the caravans of forced migrants that is not being told and is part of the story that really ought to be told.
Now, that story goes a little farther, I think, in that, I mean, throughout Latin America, we've seen over 100 invasions in the last 100 years by the United States. But very little is known of the participation of Canadian policy in this process of violence production and, you know, and entrenching governments that are, you know, neo-fascist and governments that are murderous to the people. So can we talk a little bit about the relationship? Because while the Canadian government sees Nicolas Maduro, the elected president in Venezuela, as the evil incarnate, you know, they seem to stand quite comfortably next to Brazilian President Bolsonaro or the Colombian regimes of Iván Duque, or, you know, and in the case, as you point out, in Honduras, in Guatemala, the level of violence continues to exacerbate and very little is said. So let's talk a little bit about not just the conditions that are forcing people to cause, but some of the root causes. And in particular, I'm thinking of the coup that took place in 2009. How did that unfold, and why is it important for us to remember that now?
Well, before getting to the Honduran coup, which is about to... It's a very depressing 10th anniversary. What you talk about now with the role of the Canadian government side by side with the U.S. government is fundamental. And the key thing here is that this is Canadian policy at play. I think many of us Canadians and Americans, we think that our responsibility is sort of municipal politics, provincial or state politics, federal politics. But we rarely pay attention to or do anything to hold our governments to account for policies and actions that occur outside our borders. But what Canada is doing along with the United States now with respect to trying to overthrow the government of Venezuela and to directly support very corrupt, repressive regimes in Brazil, Colombia, Guatemala, and Honduras, that's as much Canadian policy at play as... as I said, municipal or provincial affairs. And it's up to Canadian people to hold our governments, our media, our economic, our companies and investors accountable for directly contributing to great human rights suffering and corruption and impunity in other countries while trying to illegally overthrow the government of Venezuela. It's really shocking and relentlessly violent. And then Honduras, the question you ask about Honduras becomes sadly an awfully good example of all that. Honduras is arguably the most violent, repressive, and destitute country in the Americas today, perhaps comparable with Haiti, and Guatemala might not be far behind. And Honduras' modern nightmare today began 10 years ago on June 27th, 2009, when the economic elites in Honduras and the military generals and the hierarchy of the police, the Catholic Church, and the corrupted Congress planned and carried out a military coup and ousted the democratically elected government of President Zelaya and forced him out of the country at gunpoint, President Zelaya and all of his major leading cabinet ministers. And Canada and the U.S. fully supported this coup and legitimized the coup and then started immediately working with the post-coup governments. And for the past 10 years, Canada and the United States have been the number one supporters, military, economic, and political, of a series of corrupt, narco-trafficking, military-backed regimes in Honduras. And then to tie it back to what we were already talking about, a significant majority of the people hitting the U.S. border as refugees trying to get asylum are fleeing Honduras and the extraordinarily violent, corrupted conditions that exist throughout the country.
When we think about the impacts of a military coup or an economic coup, and they take many forms, we don't often think about the individual stories of people that get caught up in the violence, the political prisoners, the families, the impact on their communities. There's one particular story that I think is important to talk about, and that is of Karen Spring and her partner, who is a political prisoner in Honduras. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, thank you for bringing up that case. And I will. I'm quite involved with it. I know Karen very well. I've known Edwin for the political prisoner for 10 years. You're right to highlight the fact that all of these generalizations have to do with individual lives. And we could easily talk about the assassination of Berta Cáceres, this incredibly empowering and moving indigenous anti-imperialist feminist leader who was assassinated in March of 2016 by the Honduran economic and military elites because she was such a powerful community leader and articulated a vision of a different Honduras that everyone's fighting for. So Berta Cáceres was assassinated, and to date there's been no justice for her killing. Edwin Espinal is similar to Berta in some ways. He wasn't as powerful and widely known as a leader, but he was just as well known as a support person. For over 10 years, Edwin Espinal has been one of hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Hondurans who have been just so enraged because of the coup in 2009 and then a series of 10 years of corrupt narco-trafficking, violent governments. And he supports protest movements and opposition political parties. They're trying to do whatever they can to resist the harms and to bring about serious reform in the country. And this efforts at reform are always met with violence and repression and corruption. And in January of 2018, so a year and a half ago, January 19th, 2018, Edwin became once again a direct victim of the who was illegally detained and stuck in jail on trumped up criminal charges simply because he was protesting fraudulent, violent elections and corruption and state repression and murder. And so he's been awaiting trial, quote unquote, awaiting trial in a maximum security military jail since January of 2018. And then what brings it close to home is that his longtime partner in life is Karen Spring. She's a Canadian human rights defender, a Canadian human rights expert, and she's lived in Honduras for 10 years. She worked for 5 years or so with Rights Action, with me at Rights Action. And for the last 5 years, she's been heading up what's known as the Honduras Solidarity Network. And Karen, in her own right, is a courageous and outspoken human rights defender. And then all of a sudden, now she's a family member also of a victim of repression. So since January of 2018, Karen, who's worked down there for 10 years, and along with her mother, Janet Spring, who's the mother-in-law of Edwin, they've been spearheading this incredibly frustrating, difficult, and dangerous struggle to try and pressure the Honduran regime via the U.S. and Canadian governments to let all the political prisoners go, including Edwin Espinal, and have all the trumped-up charges dropped. And they're getting nowhere fast. It's an incredibly exemplary and difficult struggle.
And yet it's a familiar struggle, right? Here in British Columbia, we see how the Wet'suwet'en people were targeted, you know, by military attacks, you know, for defending against the pollution of their lands, for defending against yet another expansion of pipelines in their territories. And so I think it's important to know that this, to talk about the violence that is committed by the state in our name, is to also take the responsibility to act to stop the violence, first of all,
yeah.
To correct the harms done, right? To correct the ravages that have been committed in our name. So how do we create then a process, you know, to not just justice, but a process that allows us to have political visibility? So politics is not something that happens in the, you know, in secret rooms where, you know, high officials and, you know, wealthy people get together and decide what to do. But how do we create a political movement that is of the people, by the people, and for the people?
I think it is to take politics, especially so-called foreign policy politics, out of those back rooms, out of secret rooms in Ottawa and certain rooms in foreign affairs in Ottawa, and out of the rooms where global corporations have access, and say, no, this is public policy. This policy should be on the front page alongside the municipal politics, provincial politics, and federal politics. That's never been easy, even with municipal, provincial, and federal politics. Everyone in Canada who's concerned about human rights issues, environmental issues, justice issues, knows that when wrongdoing is done, there's serious efforts by politicians and or business people or the guilty parties to cover it up. All of that happens multiplied many times over at the international level. And so part of our challenge is to take foreign policy out of these back rooms, out of the purview of the embassy and the quote-unquote foreign policy experts, and understand it as domestic policy, and that we have to hold our politicians accountable. We have to make it a political issue in every election, just as we're making jobs a political issue, as access to health a political issue, as all kinds of reforms at the domestic level. We have to make foreign policy a political issue. The media has a huge role in that. And I am someone who's, in terms of Canadian mainstream media, whereas our media oftentimes might play a useful role in exposing wrongdoing at the municipal or local levels, our mainstream media, I think, is oftentimes doing a very complicit role when it comes to foreign policy issues. They are become, I might be overgeneralizing, but they become public relations offices for Canadian foreign policy. And so the Canadian media, for example, fundamentally supported the U.S. and Canadian-backed coup in Honduras 10 years ago. The Canadian media, while addressing the plight of some of the migrants being forced to flee and try and get into the U.S., is religiously not asking the questions as to what Canadian and U.S. policy has to do with creating those conditions. And there would be many other examples. Those are the two sides of the answer to me. We have to take foreign policy issues out of the back room, away from the so-called experts, who I don't consider to be experts at all, and make it a discussion and debate in the general society. And we have to challenge our mainstream media to do their jobs right, and report in a fair and balanced way, impartial way, as best they can, on foreign policy issues, just like they do on domestic issues. That's a bare minimum starting point. Once that happens, all of these sort of activists, these small groups, Honduras Solidarity Network, Rights Action, a myriad of small groups across Canada, we will come forward and add our expertise and our voice to these debates. And we will also start giving voice to the people of Honduras and Guatemala who are suffering the harms not only of the policies of their own governments, but of U.S. and Canadian foreign policy. We need to give voice to those people and then demand reform and accountability.
I wanted to not only point out that we are not invisible because, you know, we don't speak up, but we're invisibilized by the structures, by the, you know, juridical, economic, media structures that are put in place to defend the rights of the very few minority, you know. So, but I want to talk more importantly about also the fact that despite all those things being against us, there is an incredible resilience, you know, and there is an incredible momentum that is created by people organizing and coming together. And the Wet'suwet'en people are just an example for us here in British Columbia of, you know, just because the government makes the wrong decision doesn't mean the people have to go along with it. And there's still a struggle going on here. But I want to talk a little bit about what have we learned from the Honduran struggle? What have we learned from the way the people have responded?
Well, I think in a word, it's when in doubt, support the people, whether they're in British Columbia, First Nations in British Columbia, or the Honduran people. When in doubt, support the people who are suffering the harms and violations and who are resisting and fighting back. You and I have been talking a lot about the challenges to reform Canadian foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy, challenge the role of the mainstream media. And I believe in all that. And work must be ongoing to hold them accountable. Hold the media accountable for its misreporting, for its censorship. Hold our governments accountable, our companies accountable. But first and last, always support the people who are suffering the harms and violations and who are fighting back. And that's the most uplifting, if not sobering and sad, but that's the most uplifting side of the work that Rights Action does. That even when trying to transform the power structures at the national and international level seems so daunting and one feels so helpless. I never feel helpless when we are able to directly support the Honduran people, Berta Cáceres's organization, COPIN, or Karen Spring, and the extraordinary women who are fighting every day to support the rights of the political prisoners, I get in Espinal, or the mining harmed communities in Honduras, or the communities whose lands are being ravaged by the production of African palm and sugarcane and bananas. Those struggles are going on, and those people will always stand up and fight to defend their lands and their environment and their rights because they're fighting for their lives. So that is sort of the default position, I think, of any struggle. Support the people on the so-called front lines, come what may.
When I think about the power that comes not only from supporting, but also from feeling embraced and engaged with life, because really that's what we're doing. You know, we have one planet, we have one Earth, and we all depend on everything. You know, we all depend on each other to be well. When Hondurans do well, we do well. When the fish in the ocean, you know, thrive, we will thrive. So it's always an interconnected, you know, process of co-creating with life and recognizing we all have a responsibility, right? The ability to respond. So what inspires you and how do you keep yourself motivated in those days when, you know, we face a lot of challenges, we face a lot of setbacks, and every time we win reform, you know, it's only a few years later we have to fight for it again. So how do you keep yourself, you're a lawyer, you see the not only the ramifications, but you also see the structural, you know, barriers. How do you keep yourself charged?
Well, just from the notion that you've already discussed, that I do have that understanding that you were referring to, that we are sort of one people on this planet, and we're one people amidst uncountable life forms on this planet, and there's only one planet. Many of the people I work with, both in Canada, the U.S., and throughout Central America, have gone beyond this sort of imposed and in some ways false nation state structure. People that I work with are not sort of, I'm Canadian first and to the hell with the rest of them, or I'm American first and the hell with the rest of them, or I'm whatever. It is, no, we're one people on this planet amidst many life forms, and there's only one planet that provides us life. So my personal well-being is tied into that understanding. The second thing that keeps me going is also in this nation state system that we have, that I think in many ways is part of the problem, it is my responsibility. So beyond it's sort of my personal and spiritual understanding, but it's my responsibility as a Canadian to hold my government accountable if it engages in wrongdoing at the municipal level, the provincial, federal, or global levels. And it's my responsibility as a Canadian to hold our companies and investors accountable if they're profiting from the suffering of other humans or other life forms elsewhere around the planet, or contributing to environmental destruction around the planet. So there's that responsibility element because I'm linked to it. And then thirdly, I'm just incredibly inspired and moved by the people that I get to work with in Honduras and Guatemala. And I've known many of these people for 15, 20 or 25 years. They're my friends. But I'm inspired by the fact that they get up every day and fight back. And then I'm like, heck, well, I'm going to do whatever I can to support them in their worthy and dignified struggles.
For people who have not been engaged in struggle, what is one thing that they could do today that would make a difference?
Two things. One is change the daily media that they listen to. Start listening to whatever you want to call it, alternative radio, alternative media programs on an ongoing basis. And there are many out there. And so that one fills one's mind and thinking with more creative, more critical sources of information on a regular month-in, month-out basis. And then secondly, I think the challenge is to for any and everyone to understand their lives is not of that of a Canadian citizen here in this bubble we call Canada, but as one human on one planet, and to understand the relationships between Mother Earth and all that gives us life on this planet, and then all other people and life forms with whom we co-inhabit this one planet.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us today. Thank you for all the ways that you continuously inspire me to do more, to see the possibilities, and to know that no struggle can last forever, and the people will be here to face it, and we will succeed. We will, you know, have the world we co-create. And so I'm inspired by your work. How can people access your work?
rightsaction.org, www.rightsaction.org.
Thank you again. Have a great day.
You too now.
Here is a news report from Al Jazeera 10 years ago. Our mainstream media did a dismal job covering this coup, just as they're doing a dismal job towards Venezuela. Honduras is one of the most violent countries in the world, and this is why you're seeing the migrant caravan. But here's just a brief news clip from 10 years ago.
Angry protesters at the doorsteps of Honduras' presidential palace want President Manuel Zelaya back. The army took over the palace and sealed the entrances, their weapons at the ready. Wielding sticks and steel batons, Zelaya's supporters tried to push themselves through the gate, now guarded by troops in riot gear. Columns of smoke from tires set alight blocked the street outside the palace. It all began at dawn on Sunday when some 200 soldiers surrounded the president's private home. They took him at gunpoint and flew him out of the country to neighboring Costa Rica. A local journalist here could not hide her frustration.
For the first time we had a president, a great president who was defending the poor. And simply because he was defending our cause, he was kidnapped this morning. And I weep these tears of indignation.
After arriving in Costa Rica, Zelaya told his supporters they should protest in peace while insisting he remained the rightful president of Honduras.
I ask them to keep calm, but at the same time to defend the rights of society. If we ourselves cannot defend the rights of society, I call for a peaceful resistance without violence. I ask them to seek civil disobedience in a nonviolent way.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com.